Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Colonel Pat Lang, who's the former Chief of Middle East Intelligence at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And we'll be talking to him about the outing of Ambassador Wilson's wife at the CIA, the extent to which there's a kind of insurrection in the intelligence, among the intelligence professionals, against both the treatment of her and the lack of intelligence to get the United States into the war in Iraq, or perhaps not the lack of intelligence, but the slanting of intelligence. And we'll also talk to an Iraqi nuclear scientist who worked in the Iraq atomic energy program from 1968 to 1998. He escaped with his family in 1998 from Iraq. And we'll be talking to him about what he remembers or saw in terms of weapons of mass destruction and other biological and chemical programs, given that the CIA advisor David Kaye issued his report on the hunt for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and essentially came up empty, although he did suggest that there was an aspirational program somewhere out there. And it's a question of how actual it is and whether it'll be found. But he did ask for another $610 million to continue the search. So we'll be talking about that. We'll also talk with Sheldon Rampton, who's a co-author of Weapons of Mass Deception. He's with the Center for Media and Democracy. And we're talking to him about the Iraqi National Congress and the extent to which he claims it is created by a public relations firm, the Rendon Group. I'm speaking with Colonel Pat Lang, who was formerly the head of the Middle East Intelligence at the Defense Intelligence Agency and is a regular on the NewsHour on PBS. And am I correct in detecting some kind of insurrection going on amongst the ranks of intelligence professionals against the outing of the wife of Ambassador Wilson? Apparently, it's rather sort of petty and nasty kind of, almost childish kind of retribution for the fact that Ambassador Wilson wrote an article in the New York Times refuting the administration's claims of Saddam getting uranium from Niger. And I also understand that Alan Foley, the head of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Program at the CIA, has left as well. So can you give us an extent, Colonel, a picture, Colonel Lang, of what is happening amongst the rank-and-file intelligence professionals?
Well, look, you know, intelligence people are generally broadly divided into analysts who are researchers and writers, basically, on the one hand, and field collectors, on the other hand, whose business it is to recruit overseas foreign nationals to spy against their own governments or groups that are hostile to the United States. And your ability to do that is predicated upon the people you're going to try to recruit overseas believing that you're going to be able to protect their identities against really severe retribution, imprisonment, or perhaps even death. And so in order to do that, you have to protect the identity of the Americans who do this kind of work, even after they leave that kind of work, because it's easy to work your way backward from these people to people they knew in foreign countries and places to figure out who their contacts are, and then you can run them down. Now, a consistent theme in all the disasters that have occurred to us over the last 10 years, El Khobar, Towers, or 9/11, one thing or another, are politicians bleating about the idea that we don't have good enough clandestine human intelligence. And now what we have evidently here is an instance in which people who are on the payroll of the United States as political appointees decided for reasons of revenge of a rather crass political nature in order to disclose the identity of this woman. It's bad enough that this woman's career is blighted and people she dealt with are endangered, but the very structure of clandestine intelligence and the ability of CIA people and defense people to do this kind of work overseas is endangered by this kind of reckless stupidity. And I hope to God somebody does something about it.
It is a rather stark irony that a government whose main concern, at least the stated concern, is to stop the spread of weapons of mass destruction, and to quote President Bush, having the world's most dangerous weapons in the hands of the world's most dangerous dictators. The notion that one of the leading specialists in the weapons of mass destruction arena, her career has been ruined, and apparently her boss, Alan Foley, has left the CIA feeling that he was hung out to dry by the administration. So this is an administration that's decimating the very talent that it needs to hunt down weapons of mass destruction.
Well, in fact, from the end of the Cold War throughout the 90s, the intelligence community, both in its analytic function and its collection function, tended to run downhill from neglect and lack of interest, a kind of belief that history had come to an end. What a foolish idea that was. And now there's been much talk about how this is going to be reversed and it's all going to be built up. But in fact, on the analytic side, in the run-up to the war against Iraq, people who were professional analysts, both at CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, experienced a kind of relentless pressure to make their views and their publicly stated opinions conform to a policy which had already been decided. To say that they're unhappy about that is to really understate the case. And now we have this instance in which the clandestine operators find that their very lives are threatened and their ability to do their work by this kind of foolishness.
Now, did you ever have a recruiting interview with the neocons? Is that something that I've pulled out of the air? Or?
Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, I think that if the neocons are a group, there are certain people who have been the progenitors and mentors of this group. And there was one occasion in the early 90s, just after the first Gulf War, in which unexpectedly a couple of people showed up in my office to talk a lot of nonsense to me about their views about how the United States should rule the world justly. And when they didn't get a satisfactory answer from me, they left, and were quite unhappy, I believe. And I've talked to other people who were in similar positions. They had similar visits.
So you were sort of felt like you got on a list. Is that what you're implying? Or
I feel that I flunked my audition, and I'm very happy that I did.
And what about, I know you've been a regular on the NewsHour, Colonel Pat Lang, can you explain why it is that, for example, this story about Ambassador Wilson's wife took so long to, I guess it was essentially the floodgates were open when the CIA decided to go to the Justice Department. Maybe that gave journalists cover. But what's going on here in terms of the timid journalism covering these critical issues?
Well, in this particular instance, I think Ambassador Wilson stated the case about his wife early on. I know that he mentioned it to me at least once in one of these network green rooms, and I thought it was interesting but didn't know what to make of it. And what gave this thing legs is when the CIA referred the matter to the Justice Department for a criminal inquiry, as is normal in a case like this. There's some question as to whether or not Director Tenet himself was involved in that, or the legal department at CIA. I don't know what the answer to that is. But in fact, I think what you're referring to is the fact that I've been told on a number of occasions by media people, some of them at the executive level, that this administration is even more active in exerting a kind of pressure on the networks, especially, to be careful about what they say, because there's an implied threat, never clearly stated, that perhaps their access to various matters might be more limited if they push things too aggressively and put people like Joe Wilson on television too much.
So this is what's the quid pro quo, though? I mean, what can the White House threaten them with?
Well, it's very simple. Everybody in the media, as you know, lives by access. If you don't have access to people in the government who can tell you what is going on in the world and give you some insight and some leads to follow in developing stories, then you're, in fact, been neutered. You're a sort of steer in the world of journalism, and you're not going to get anywhere. And so if people decide they're going to shut you out of access to talking to anybody, then you're not going to do very well. And if people listening to you don't understand that the government gives a great many interviews on background to journalists as in the process of informing them or shaping their opinions, then they don't understand the situation very well, because that is what goes on.
And of course, to take that one step further, the leaking of Ambassador Wilson's wife is also the kind of stuff that goes on, where six reporters, along with Novak, were called by, apparently, Scooter Libby and John Hannah, the fingers are being pointed. Let's turn to Iraq, since you were the head of Chief of Middle East Intelligence at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and you taught Arabic language at West Point, and it's extraordinary. I've found that the few people that one can talk to actually know something about Iraq were the least consulted in the lead up to this war, and it's by all measures it doesn't look like it's going well. Now, what's your reading on where we stand? Because it does seem that every day that goes by, it seems that those that want to drive America out seem to be capturing more of the initiative. And in spite of the tremendous amount of money that's being poured in through American contractors, it doesn't seem like we're actually jump-starting the nation-building of Iraq.
Well, on your first point, I was on a panel at the Middle East Policy Council the other day, and there was a kind of informal survey conducted of people in the audience who were real cognoscenti with regard to Iraq, have written extensively on it, a lot of experience there. To ask them, well, how many of them had ever been asked their opinion about anything concerning Iraq before this policy that resulted in the war really got locked in? And the answer was zero, to include me. And I've been to Iraq a lot. And I think that that's a remarkable thing, that in fact that this was kind of a closed shop deal in which the captive intelligence agencies were under a lot of pressure to produce results that were acceptable to the administration's policy, and that hasn't produced a very fruitful result, as you can see from Mr. Kay's interim report. As for how the war is going, well, I think you know that the major question to be asked is who is on the other side. Now, if the administration maintains stoutly that there are a handful of former Baathists and a few military personnel and some foreign terrorists, people of that kind. And if that is true, then I would say from prior experience in a number of what used to be called counterinsurgency campaigns, that word's out of favor now, that in the end, the pressure of our counter-guerrilla operations and our civic action getting life back to normal will eventually wear these people down. If, on the other hand, what you have is a manifestation of Arab nationalism and Iraqi nationalism, Islamic fanaticism brought together on the battlefield of Iraq to oppose us, then it's going to be a long, drawn-out matter. And I see a lot of people now saying that, well, life is going on a fairly normal basis in Baghdad. Well, I don't find that to be particularly surprising. You know, I was in the war in Vietnam for several years, and life went on in Saigon in a very normal manner while people were fighting all around the outskirts of the city. So I don't think that especially is proof of anything, and we're going to have to wait and see what the situation is like 9 months or a year from now.
But it would seem, though, to be brutally honest, if that's not too portentous a term, that if you haven't this kind of insurgency where the guerrillas are picking off American soldiers as sort of soft targets whenever they're driving on highways and whenever their backs are turned, as it were, the way that the Nazis handled the insurrection in France, for example, where if a Nazi soldier was killed by the Marquis, they shot, you know, one German soldier, they shot 10 French civilians. You know, I mean, clearly, I'm not advocating that, but it seems to me that even with those kind of brutal measures, insurrections haven't been necessarily defeated. So, and obviously, America cannot do that kind of thing. So, where is what kind of strategy can they adopt to stop? Obviously, the hearts and minds is where they should be focused, but I'm not sure that they are.
Well, look, in the 1960s, under the Kennedy administration and the early Johnson administration, the United States adopted a very deliberate strategy of opposing wars of national liberation around the world, and a technique of applying national level political and agrarian reforms with vigorous counter guerrilla operations, training of local units for that kind of work, and then a lot of what is called civic action at the village and town level of opening schools and running local health clinics and making sure that local industries thrive. That kind of thing was applied in South America, in particular in Central America, with a great deal of success, in fact. In any number of places, insurgencies that had been pushed hard by the Cubans, in fact, fell completely apart under that kind of pressure. When we tried to apply the same kind of methods in Vietnam, it failed miserably, because what we found was that there was a large-scale commitment on the part of at least a significant part of the population to the other side's cause. Now, that's the key question, as I was saying a few minutes ago. To what extent are the Iraqi people interested in having the country pacified by us and having them move forward socially and economically? And on the other hand, to what extent are they committed to the idea of resisting us? On that question hangs a great deal.
But, for example, in Central America, in Guatemala, the insurgency, or the counterinsurgency, the U.S. sort of kept a distance, but the Guatemalan military were abjectly, horrendously brutal. So, I mean, in this case, you're not going to find any Iraqis to do your dirty work for you.
Well, we didn't find any Guatemalans to do our dirty work for us either, if that's what you're implying. In fact, in Guatemala in the mid-60s, the United States advocated the application of the kind of methods that I was speaking of. And to the surprise of everybody on the American side, they decided to do things their way. And people were quite surprised, although I have to admit that they did, in fact, break the back of the insurgency in rural Guatemala.
At the cost of, what, 250,000 peasants, right?
I don't remember the number, but it was a lot.
Right. Well, tell me about, Colonel Lang, about what do you think is happening in terms of nation building here? It's going to be terribly hard to build a nation if our soldiers are hunkered down in kind of Fort Apache-type fortresses. So we've only got 1,000 civilians with the civilian reconstruction group, at least maybe 2,000 max. A lot of money apparently is being appropriated, there's talk of $50,000 per prison cell and all this kind of, and in fact, the senator from West Virginia the other day was complaining about the kind of costs of what we're going to be spending on in Iraq. But I understand that most of this money is being spent on American contractors and subcontractors, and it's not actually, you could get it, done for a dime on the dollar by the local Iraqis.
Well, first of all, I think you're right in saying that there has been some retraction of the sort of grassroots presence of the U.S. Army in amongst the Iraqi population, because it's been found to be just too dangerous to run foot patrols in various places in the country. So you're having a lot more concentration in places where our people can be defended. But at the same time, I think it would be unfair not to say that the troops are doing their best in a lot of these villages and towns to do good things for the people of Iraq. I think that's a fair statement. And if in fact the commitment to the other side is not too great, this will have an effect in time. As for the business non-competitive contracting for major players on the American side in Iraq, I mean, this is a subject which I think ought to be investigated by the Congress, because the extent to which the money invested in various companies over there is actually being applied to the problem, I think, is problematical. And that is complicated, of course, by the fact that the security situation is so bad. I mean, there's no commercial air service in and out of Baghdad International. There's no likelihood of any commercial air service soon. Things are dangerous on the ground. There are not many major corporations that are going to be willing to risk their executive-level personnel or managerial personnel in such a situation. They may ship a lot of workers in from the third world someplace, but that's not the same thing as actually making a long-term commitment to the development of Iraq.
Well, but in a broader kind of macro sense, though, and you worked for the Pentagon for a number of years.
32 years.
So you were there through the Cold War and at the end of the Cold War, the the budget was up to about $300 billion a year. Now it's up to 400 and heading to 450 in a matter of 2 or 3 years. So in your day, apparently, there was still a lot of excess. But when you got this kind of money, surely it seems like they're just throwing tons and tons of money at a problem that they haven't quite defined. And I don't know how all this money is being spent. Do you?
Well, I don't. A lot of the money that's being applied is actually being applied to U.S. forces. But I think there's a suitable subject for inquiry here as to how some of the discretionary funds that are being used for development are being used, how much of it is going into corporate overhead, and how much of it is actually reaching in projects that are needed on the ground. Government contracting is inherently wasteful because everybody figures that public money is no one's money, which is a terribly stupid idea since we all pay taxes. But I think that you're onto something there, and this is something that ought to be looked at more closely.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Colonel Patrick Lang.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking then with Colonel Pat Lang, who is a former chief of the Middle East Intelligence at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Imad Haduri, who is an Iraqi nuclear scientist. He served with the Iraqi Atomic Energy Program from 1968 to 1998. In 1998, he escaped from Iraq with his family, and you were in Toronto, Canada. And tell me, from somebody that was inside the Iraqi nuclear program, were you surprised that David Kay, the CIA advisor, in his interim report released a couple of days ago, hasn't found very much? Although he did go on to say that Saddam aspired to both nuclear weapons, biological programs, and chemical programs.
Not really. I'm not surprised at all. I came out to say that David Kay will not be finding anything even 2 months ago in an article when titled The Circle of Lies Coming to an End. Since the 1991 war, Iraq's nuclear program came to a halt, nuclear weapon program, and all the nuclear staff, engineers, and scientists were diverted to the rehabilitation of Iraq's electric power stations, oil refineries, and telephone exchanges, which, by the way, we did within a short period of a few months. The Americans seems to be unable to do even 1% of what we did at the time. But since then, there was no rejuvenation of the Iraqi nuclear weapon program at all. And when I first heard President Bush last August coming out and claiming that this Iraqi nuclear weapon threat is a threat against United States security, and I could discern that there will be an occupation of Iraq, a war criminal occupation of Iraq, I came out and I started writing that they will find nothing as far as the nuclear weapon program is concerned, and it was not rejuvenated.
And you're satisfied that none of this stuff has been squirreled and spirited off to Syria, for example?
If you're talking about the nuclear weapon program, as I said, the whole program terminated in 1991, and there was no rejuvenation of any part of it. I challenged, even a year ago, the American, British, and Israeli intelligence to come up with one shred of evidence of any rejuvenation. If you're talking about the biological and the chemical, I myself was not in the complete clear, I didn't have any clear facts on these two weapons. And I started to get a glimpse of what happened to them in February of this year, when an interview, which was given in 1995, but suppressed for 8 years by the American intelligence and by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Commission. In 1995, Hussein Kamel, the person who was in complete charge of all weapons of mass destruction programs.
That's Saddam's son-in-law.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In 1995, when he escaped to Jordan, escaping Saddam, he gave this interview to the Hans Blix at the time of the IAEA, at the UNSCOM, as it was called, and the CIA, of course. And he told them that he gave the orders immediately after the war in 1991 to destroy all the chemical and biological inventories and the warheads. And this was carried out. And he told the Hans Blix where this site is. And Hans Blix seemed to know this site from the interview He said, do you mean that site north of Baghdad? And Hussein Kamel said, yes. Now, even that report was suppressed, as I said, for 8 years. And when that came out in February, I still was not completely convinced of this fact. But I was 100% convinced when, after the occupation of Baghdad, 3 days later, the chief scientific consultant, his name is General Amr Saadi, who is a very distinguished scientist and of high integrity, he gave himself up to the American occupying forces. Before that, by 1 hour, he gave a German television interview. And he said, I've been saying the truth for the past 10 years. Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction. And time will bear me out. And time is bearing him out. And he's still in custody.
Now, what about the notion, which I've often suggested, and I'm perfectly prepared to be wrong, and I sometimes am. So tell me, is it possible that the scientists, the people with the knowledge, because particularly with bacteriological weapons programs, the technology is pretty cheap. It's off the shelf. The real issue is the software, the knowledge, not the hardware. Is it possible that any of the people that, because it's always, some people think it's quite ironic that President Bush has raised the specter of Saddam Hussein getting together with al-Qaeda. And if you invade a country and drive people underground, then you may well be doing that. So I'm asking you simply, do you have any knowledge or do you have any suspicion that some people with weapons of mass destruction knowledge could have gone underground and joined these subnational groups?
Well, let President Bush sleep on that. But I'll say the following. When the Americans offered a $200,000 reward for any of our scientists to come forward to give any indication of the whereabouts of these chemical and biological, the Los Angeles Times, in April, I believe, April 21st of this year, the man I know in charge of the chemical program, a General Saad, I think his name is, in the Los Angeles Times have published, he said, look, wouldn't I go and get the $200,000 reward if I knew there was any chemical weapons around? But the fact is that there is none. So I could not collect the $200,000, so I didn't go. And not a single scientist has come forward to claim that $200,000 because they have no evidence in their hands. As simple as that.
But what about knowledge?
That's now, whether to knowledge sake, there President Bush should not be sleeping well. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me then about some of the people that have come out. I was always a little bit suspicious of this guy, Hamzi, that I interviewed once, who wrote a book called Saddam's Bomb Maker, because he got out of the country and left his family behind, which seemed a rather odd thing to do, given the nature of the vicious nature of the Saddam regime. Who has been telling the administration about weapons of mass destruction? Because recently, the White House rather extraordinarily said, well, you know, they leaked this story saying, well, maybe, you know, we weren't lying to you about weapons of mass destruction. Maybe we're just stupid that we listened to the wrong people, that we were listening to Iraqi defectors who was blowing smoke.
Well, with the CIA coffers of, 20, $30 billion a year, they couldn't discern such false information. That's their problem. But let me talk about the source of this misinformation. You mentioned this gentleman, Khidr Hamza. I wrote about this gentleman 2 years ago, and even last year translated into English, that he is full of lies. And just 5 days ago, the New York Times had an article about the source of this information. They mentioned Khidr Hamza's name as being one of this invalid information. I wrote an article response to that, to the New York Times in the op-ed section. And they said, wait 10 days for it to be published. I doubt it will be published. And as you said correctly, this man left Iraq and left his family behind to the mercy of Saddam's intelligence, cruel intelligence. And his son came to him in Libya, begging him to come back to Iraq. And he shunned his son again. And he went back to Bulgaria begging the IAEA and the CIA and the M16 and the Iraqi National Congress with Ahmed Chalabi and Ayad Alawi. They are the two heads of the opposition groups who are now in Iraq's governing council. He begged them to take them in. They wouldn't. His only chance came when Hussein Kamel, coincidentally, had escaped Iraq in 1995 and told the American CIA that there were documents hidden in his farm. Then the CIA took this gentleman to, and he started mouthing their misinformation. Even before that, while he was still in Libya, he issued some reports in the Times, of the London Times, through the INC, through the Iraq National Congress, led by Ahmed Chalabi, three articles claiming that Iraq has rejuvenated its weapon programs. The IAEA was approached with these articles. The IAEA said, these are fakes. This guy is lying. More or less, they said that. The New York, the Times of London not even bothered to retract the articles, and they still haven't. This guy is a complete fraud. He went into Iraq behind the American tanks, and he's been there for 5 months. Before that, even 1 week before the occupation, he was on CNN saying Iraq within 1 or 2 years will have 3 to 4 or 5 atomic bombs. He's been saying that for the past 5 years. How come no American media, neither Fox, nor NBC, nor ABC, nor CNN, have gotten an accounting from this gentleman? You have been saying for 5 years Iraq is just close enough to get atomic bomb. What do you say now? You've been there five months. Nobody has asked this question. And I wonder how fair is the American media consequently.
Well, now, did you ever know this guy when you worked in the atomic energy and on the nuclear
program? In my article, if you go to the site of... I've written a book just come out this week, actually. It's probably the American bookstores now. It's called Iraq's Nuclear Mirage. And the site is www.iraqsnuclearmirage.com. One of the first articles I've written, which is on that site, explains my knowledge of this gentleman, whom I have known for the past 33 years, worked for them since 1974. And I outlined his history and his complete undisciplined and I don't want to use, you know, words on the air.
Well, some words you can't use.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah. I know. Hello?
Yes, I'm with you.
So, but did he have any, was his technical and professional credentials, were they accurate or were they embellished?
No, this is not the case. He has a PhD in theoretical physics from Florida State University. But all his work at the Atomic Energy Commission in the 70s was dealing with a three-body problem which has nothing to do with critical mass or nuclear weapons. Suddenly he claims to be the Saddam's bomb maker, while in fact, he actually was in the program which was started in 1981 when Israel belligerently attacked Iraq's French-built nuclear reactors. Saddam took the decision, political decision, go get me the bomb, nuclear bomb, in 1981. He was with that group, and I was with that group also, for 6 years. He was working on the gas diffusion method, one of the methods of enrichment. Failing that, he wrote an article, a report to Saddam Hussein, claiming that the leader, the scientific leader of the program, his name is Jafar, Diyar Jafar, who is now in the Gulf, is failing and is not coming up to promise. Saddam ordered an investigation. There was a reshuffle of the whole program, and this gentleman was given the task of the nuclear bomb design, the design group. He lasted there in that position for only 3 months. Because he pilfered some air conditioning units from the building he was given. That led to his complete exorcism. He was reduced to nothing, back to his three-body problem. He retired in 1989 when the nuclear weapon program was in full swing. He escaped in 1994. And in the interim period between 89 and 94, he was a swindler in the stock market. And that's his credentials. And I could go on and go on.
Well, he sounds like our kind of guy, I must say.
Yes.
But tell me, though, why do you believe, if you say Saddam was actively trying to make a bomb in 89, and you apparently were working on it, right?
Yes.
Why did he decide to give it all up in 91?
It wasn't a matter of choice. When the Americans, the bombers, attacked Iraq in 1991 in January, they hit several of our establishments. We had about 8 or 9 establishments. And the Americans hit a couple of them. And the two of them, by sheer luck, the last day, 2 days of the bombing campaign. And that showed us the extent of the lack of knowledge of the CIA of the scope of our nuclear weapon program, because they missed several crucial buildings. They didn't bomb them. One of them was the center for the design of the nuclear bomb itself. The only bomb that reached that center was a thermal-guided bomb on an electrical substation outside the fence of that establishment. Only when the inspectors came, the inspectors, among them David Kaye, and they realized the extent and the scope of the program, did they go around and they demolished, they bombed, they actually exploded with demolition bombs the rest of the establishments of the nuclear weapon program. Hence, it was not a choice. It was a matter of fact, we could not carry on this nuclear weapon program without this infrastructure. Added to that, the whole group of scientists and engineers were directed to civilian rehabilitation of the electric and oil refineries and so on. Therefore, there was no rejuvenation at all. All we had left were these ruined buildings, our memories, and the reports that we had produced in the 80s.
And there's no question that, in other words, what you're saying is that the UN inspections actually worked, which was, of course, what we were told before this latest war was that the UN inspectors are useless, you know.
Let me tell you one thing about the UN inspectors. They cost $60 million a year, their cost. And that was coming from Iraq's money, from the Iraq oil for food money. Mm-hmm. Now, 5 months with David Kaye, it has cost American taxpayer $300 million.
And he just
asked for $600
million. $610 million more he wants.
Yeah. Yes. And now, all of the IA inspectors, they were costing $60 million of Iraq's money. Well, let the American taxpayer have a taste of it.
Mm. And you don't think that once the buildings were gone, what about the blueprints? What about the knowledge? Where did that all go?
It is in our mind, and it is in the reports. And the IA inspectors got hold of all these reports. Mm-hmm. David Kaye himself got it.
Mm-hmm. And is anybody coming to you and saying, you know, you want to work for us, the North Koreans, the Iranians, or all of these so-called axis of evil people? Are you on the market?
I am a bit old for that. I am trying to make a living in Canada as a network administrator. Uh-huh. The knowledge is atrophied, in a sense.
Right. So what is going on in Iraq? I mean, you're an Iraqi. It seems to me that this is a complete disaster from America's point of view. I don't think they're going to get out of this thing. I think it's just going to get worse every day. What's your reading on it?
Well, I'm very saddened by the occupation of Iraq, and I'm even more saddened by the way that the U.S. approach to Iraq is being handled, the lack of transparency. I'll give you an example. In order to move forward for Iraq, we need to have a constitution to be written by the Iraqis themselves. Now, here, lo and behold, Wolfowitz, one of the neocons who is behind this whole drive to occupy Iraq, they have appointed somebody called Noah Feldman, Noah, N-O-A-H. Mm-hmm. He is at New York University. He should be responsible for producing a new Iraqi constitution. Now, who is this gentleman? He's only 32 years old. He is an expert in Islamic law. He knows Arabic, but he's also an Orthodox Jew. But he has never practiced law in the Arab world, never been to Iraq, and seems to have no real practical background on the problems of post-war Iraq. Now, what an open-faced snub is that, not only to Iraq itself, but also to the legions of Arab and Muslim legal minds who would have done a perfectly acceptable job in the service of our future, Iraq's future. But no, America wants it to be done by a fresh young fella so as to be able to say, we have given Iraq its new democracy. The contempt is thick enough to cut with a knife. And that's only one example of intransparency. I'll give you other examples. At the moment, Bremer has given Jordan $1.2 billion to train 35,000 Iraqi policemen. Now there's a big uproar in Iraq. We have our people, qualified trainers. We could do that job of 35,000 for one-tenth the price. And that is our money, by the way, which America, with the United States, has confiscated from the Iraqi embassy in New York and the assets. If it's our money, we should handle it. Not Bremer. And even further, Burma gave another $300 million to buy Kalashnikov machine guns and pistols for this Iraqi police force.
God, I thought the country was awash with that stuff.
Exactly. It's full. The warehouses are full of these things. Why is he going and buying $300 million? Who is now on the inside track? Which friend of Bush and the White House is on the inside track on this? I ask you. Well, why aren't we in control of our own affairs? We should be licking our own wounds. We don't need the short-sighted American approach to solving this fantastic disaster. And believe me, Americans should really keep good track of its body bags, a good inventory.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Imad Haduri.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Dr. Imad Haduri, who's an Iraqi nuclear scientist. He worked on the Iraqi Atomic Energy Program from 1968 to 1998. I'm now speaking with Sheldon Rampton, who's the co-author of Weapons of Mass Deception. He's with PR Watch and with the Center for Media and Democracy. And tell me about some of the stuff that you've uncovered here about the genesis of the Iraqi National Congress, the very people we were talking about earlier, who have been so disastrous in misleading the United States about America's being welcome in the post-war Iraq. The Iraqis would be throwing flowers on the tanks, everything would be hunky-dory, and that prior to this, of course, Saddam was building nuclear bombs. In fact, just yesterday, President Bush still said that, talked about mobile bacteriological weapons and strains of botulinum that have been cultured, etc. So he's still trying to sell this idea, even though his own arms inspector, David Kay, said they've come up empty. So give us a sense of this group that has so recklessly and consistently misled the Bush administration.
Yeah, it turns out, if you look closely, that in fact the Iraqi National Congress is the source of a great deal of the claims that were made to sell this war publicly, the claims about the weapons, the claims about the popularity of the invasion, and even the claims about alleged Iraqi links to al-Qaeda. The Iraqi National Congress was created in the early 1990s, and it was created by a public relations firm called the Rendon Group, headed by a man named John Rendon. The Rendon Group worked during Operation Desert Storm for the then-exiled government of Kuwait, and at the end of Operation Desert Storm, it went to work for the Central Intelligence Agency when the first President Bush, signed a presidential directive ordering the CIA to launch a covert operation to unseat Saddam Hussein. So in turn, the CIA hired the Rendon Group to organize an anti-Saddam propaganda campaign both inside and outside Iraq. And they did things like set up clandestine radio stations in that broadcast anti-Saddam messages from neighboring countries into Iraq, mocking the regime and calling on Iraqi officers to defect. And they also set up the Iraqi National Congress in 1992. According to a report in 1988 on ABC News, the Rendon Group actually came up with the name for the Iraqi National Congress and channeled $12 million out of covert CIA funding to it between 1992 and 1996. The purpose of this group, which I think was probably named, I think the name was chosen because of the similarity to the African National Congress. The purpose of it was to create a sort of unified Iraqi opposition and also to create a unified Iraqi opposition with goals that would be in line with the type of future for Iraq that the first Bush administration envisioned, meaning that they are very pro-privatization. They favor privatization of the Iraqi oil industry, for example, which is something that's a very unpopular idea inside Iraq and in the Middle East, but it's an idea that Ahmad Talabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress, favors. So this was the purpose of the Iraqi National Congress was not simply to be an Iraqi opposition group, but also to be an Iraqi opposition group that is sympathetic to U.S. goals for the region.
Now, I'm a bit confused here, Sheldon Ranton, because I recently spoke with Robert Baird, the former CIA operative who ran the Kurdish opposition in the north before Saddam drove them, crushed them. And he, as a CIA insider, was very bitter about the Iraqi National Congress, Chalabi, thinks that they're absolutely useless, and they just basically embezzled a lot of money. And it turns out that the INC and Chalabi, their main supporters are the neocons in the Pentagon. And I got the impression that the CIA didn't want much to do with these people and found them their credibility lacking, shall we say.
That's as a result of subsequent history. They were set up initially at the behest of the CIA, but they were strikingly ineffective on the ground. On the ground, part of their purpose was to be an Iraqi equivalent of the Contra program in Nicaragua, meaning that they were going to conduct guerrilla attacks and try to literally overthrow the government of Iraq from inside. And they were originally sold as a project that would make it possible to topple Saddam Hussein's regime without the need for U.S. military intervention. There were CIA people who talked about the Iraqi National Congress carrying out what they called a zipless coup, meaning that they would somehow instigate an uprising against Saddam Hussein on the part of his own officers. It would be very quick and painless, and there would be minimal U.S. involvement. In fact, it didn't work out that way at all. And in fact, not only did the INC's information about conditions in Iraq prove inaccurate on many cases, they participated in a disastrous attempt at military insurrection inside the country that did nothing but get a whole bunch of dissidents killed. And so the CIA in the 1990s, soured on the Iraqi National Congress, and as you're saying, decided that they were just a big waste of money and time, and turned to other anti-Iraqi groups. But the people who stayed loyal to them throughout were the neoconservatives, people like Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, the people who were part of the neocon brain trust dating back to the days of the first Bush administration. Within that circle of people, Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress remained very popular. They even referred to Chalabi as the George Washington of Iraq.
That has echoes of Ronald Reagan calling the Contras the moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers.
Yeah. And Michael Ledeen, who is one of the people who worked behind the scenes on setting up the Iraqi National Congress, has written a book about... Michael Ledeen was also heavily involved in the Iran-Contra affair, and he's written a book about his experiences. And he's talked about how the Iraqi National Congress was intended to be specifically an Iraqi version of the Contras.
Mm-hmm. Well, just like the Contras, they're not quite as unsavory as the Contras were, but certainly as incompetent. I mean, why are they still hanging in with this guy? And apparently he's even irritated, Chalabi, he's even irritated his mentor, the Bush administration. Apparently he got dressed down the other day by Condoleezza Rice for having the gall to suggest that perhaps the Americans should turn over power to the Iraqis much sooner than they plan on.
This actually isn't the first time that Chalabi has clashed with someone inside the Bush administration. Thus far, it's always been kind of a tempest in a teapot situation where they've disagreed about something and then kind of kissed and made up later. I think it's possible that this recent clash consists of Chalabi trying to prove his street credibility inside Iraq by showing that he will actually stand up and disagree with the Bush administration about something.
But he has no credibility inside Iraq, from what I understand.
No, he doesn't. But he's trying to demonstrate that he has some kind of independence. Right now, currently, Chalabi is the head of the Iraqi Governing Council, and he certainly has aspirations to become the next president or whatever the title is, the next head of state of Iraq. And you're right. Inside Iraq, he's viewed as either a figure who hasn't been in the country for a long time and no one's heard of him, or he's regarded as someone who's rather suspect and suspicious because he's so close to the United States. But But he certainly wants to try to overcome that. And one way to overcome that might be to show that he actually is willing to disagree with the United States on something. But it's a fairly minor disagreement because I think, frankly, the Bush administration at this point itself would like to get out of Iraq as quickly as possible. So I don't think that this is a major split.
Well, you know, I've often said that, Sheldon Rampton, that I believe these people are thoroughly cynical, and they've screwed up and they want the American people and the American military, they want the international community to get them out of this mess, which gets worse every day. And I don't think they care about anything more than getting reelected, and that they, at the Republican convention next year, they will simply declare victory, say that the boys and girls will be home by Christmas and get the hell out.
Right, which would be kind of the worst of all possible scenarios. Because I mean, the people who are against the war, like myself, in the months leading up to it, were warning. And the specific thing we said was that getting into Iraq would be the easy part. The hard part would be getting out. Once we got in there and destroyed their own government, it would take quite a while to set up anything resembling a stable situation. And it would be irresponsible to go in quickly and then pull out and leave the country to spin into chaos. And it appears quite possible that may be exactly what happens now, because as the political costs of staying in Iraq continue to mount, the Bush administration, I think, is going to be increasingly under pressure to look for some sort of quick fix that will get them through next year's elections. And that might involve the worst-case scenario of just pulling out and letting the country go to hell and declaring victory and then letting the consequences unfold over subsequent years.
Now, what about the this nightmare scenario that the jihadis who are pouring in there then can turn around and claim that they drove the United States out? I mean, talk about a recruitment for the endless recruitment for the war on terrorism, at least for the terrorists as opposed to those that are trying to fight the war.
Yeah, well, with regard to the jihadists, they've got a win-win situation here. Either the United States stays in Iraq, which means that they have a steady supply of targets. They get to basically practice technique on the backs of U.S. soldiers, or the U.S. pulls out, in which case they win in the way you're saying, and they get to declare victory and demonstrate that the United States turns and runs when times get tough. So either way, the jihadists are in the driver's seat right now with the situation in Iraq. And short of something happening such as a really effective internationalization of the situation in Iraq, where political control is turned over to the United Nations or something like that, I don't see how we're going to get out of that trap. It's a win-win situation for the jihadists, and I think it's a lose-lose situation for the United States and also for the people of Iraq.
So the only possible thing that could save America from this disaster would be quickly turning over the country to the Iraqis, supervised by the UN. And is that your suggestion?
That's the closest thing I can see to a positive turn of events there, and I don't know if it's even very feasible that will work. But as long as Iraq remains under U.S. occupation, then the jihadists have a perfect environment within which to operate. And turning things over to the United Nations isn't a perfect solution either.
Right. I'm not even sure that they want it, frankly. I'm not even sure the UN wants it.
No.
At least Kofi Annan's been saying that he's not going back in there unless he can get some security guarantees. Just in the last minute, though, Sheldon Rampton, our first guest, Colonel Pat Lang, former head of Chief of Middle East Intelligence at the Defense Intelligence Agency, speaks Arabic, spent a lot of time in Iraq. He and all the people that know about Iraq were never consulted by anybody in this government before this war. And the press went along with all of this jingoistic nonsense. What is wrong with the press in this country that they can't talk to people who actually know something about a subject when, you know, these people are in the phone book, for God's sake?
Well, the press in the United States following September 11 especially became very unwilling to criticize the Bush administration, even when the criticisms were coming from people like people within the U.S. military or within intelligence agencies. And that's, you know, the psychology of a post-traumatic situation, you know, a post-terrorist situation such as the one we've been living through in the United States for the past 2 years is kind of easy to understand, but it's important that that the people of the United States start to think their way out of that dilemma because of the problems it's causing. That's part of it. The other reason that the press has behaved the way it has, I think, has to do with the very impressive publicity and propaganda machine that the right wing has developed in the United States. They've got a huge network of think tanks that all echo the same message simultaneously. It creates a kind of echo chamber effect. And they've got that, and to back that up, they've built an impressive grassroots network of activists who, anytime anyone says something in the press that is perceived as unpatriotic or counter to their agenda, they immediately flood the network with phone calls and letters and complaints of liberal bias and unpatriotic behavior and so forth. And it creates a sort of patriotism police that puts the media under constant pressure not to say anything that's going to bring themselves under attack.
Well, Colonel Lang also said that he talked to some senior network executives who said that they are being pressured by the White House not to have critics of the administration like Ambassador Wilson on. So apparently they're working all sides of the street here. I thank you for joining us, Sheldon Rampton. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And again, I thank you for joining us.
Sure, anytime.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking there with Sheldon Rampton, who's the co-author of Weapons of Mass Deception. He's also with PR Watch and the Center for Media and Democracy. I thank Lewis Vandenberg for research and producing this show today, along with Mark Maxwell, the engineer. I'm Ian Masters. I thank you for joining us. This program can be heard at any time, along with archived editions at ianmasters.org. That's one word, IANMASTERS.org.